Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. I'm Harley Schlanger. I will be your host. It's March 15th, 2008, the Ides of March, a date which causes trembling for tyrants and would-be tyrants. And I think that means that Felix Rohatyn is a bit nervous today. Last Wednesday, Lyndon LaRouche gave another in a series of webcasts in which he identified the most crucial matter facing humanity today, that we are in an accelerating global financial breakdown, plunging towards a dark age, in which the leading financial forces of London, with their subordinates in the United States, typified by George Shultz and Felix Rohatyn, intend to impose a global fascist order. He stated during this webcast emphatically that the only way to defeat this fascist plot is to inspire a significant section of our population to begin to think. And that means to develop an independent capability of creative thinking, which requires developing a rigorous approach to science and classical culture. On today's program, we will investigate what Lyndon LaRouche means by rigor in science and culture. And he's not talking about rigor mortis, which is what you get with ossified figures such as Shultz and Rohatyn. We'll be joined by a panel of members of the LaRouche Youth Movement who have spent most of the last year in what is called euphemistically and literally the basement. Now, I know that in the past when I've mentioned that there are LIM members working in the basement at Lyndon LaRouche's house, some of our listeners have reacted with horror. What are you, holding them in chains? Are you brainwashing them? What are they and LaRouche really up to? So today, we will find out what members of the LaRouche Youth Movement in the basement are really up to. I'm joined today by Leona Fancheng, Peter Martinson, and Merv Fansler. So Leona, Peter, and Merv, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks, Charlie.
Hello.
All right, I'd like to begin by asking you, and you can do it sequentially or one person can speak for the group. What have you been doing in the basement these last months?
Well, for the last month, I mean, it's probably well known around the world now that we produced a video that's putting some serious pains in the sides of some London financiers. But over the past month, we finished up the video, and now we're getting back to where we were just before LaRouche deployed us on this hyperinflation video. We were putting together the latest stage of our work on Gauss, particularly the material that Gauss is working on leading up to his discovery of the orbit of Ceres in 1801, which was he spent a whole lot of time on. His main focus, his like passion, while he was a student at Göttingen University, was arithmetic, and what's now known as the complex domain. So we're putting together a pedagogical website now. It's pretty much ready to go. We just have to activate it and make it so that everybody can see it.
Well, let me ask.
What have we been doing last month?
Let me ask a question then of one of you. A lot of people have heard that this is what, in fact, you're up to, and the next question that comes up is, what is there that's so significant about Gauss as a figure in the history of science? Why would you devote so much time to working on Carl Friedrich Gauss?
Well, Gauss is an interesting figure because he's acting in a time that's fascist. It's actually very subservient. Is that the word? Subservient.
Yeah.
To a completely anti-scientific generation, a political situation around, most people know, Napoleon. But it was really actually culturally defined by the new emerging Newtonian school that was revived by Laplace. And so Gauss, for example, the specific project that nominally our project is to study Gauss's discovery of the orbit of this asteroid Ceres, which nobody could figure out. But it was funny because the way that we were able to, what we found out was that the real problem with the orbit of Ceres, about discovering the orbit of Ceres, was not some mathematical problem. It was not just a guess that Gauss was able to do, but it was a complete different thinking method that he was able to apply and then demonstrate what the overwhelming false assumptions in the population were, not just telling them, but actually demonstrating it. And so now by studying, but by demonstrating, well, by being able to show what this thought process is, we can start to get down to how we now can intervene into the mind of the current population.
Well, there was a point made recently by Lyndon LaRouche about how this is going to bring science and also the science known as mathematics generally back into popular discussion. I mean, obviously, one of the points that he was making is that in my generation, the boomer generation, matters of science have been pretty much tossed out the window because everyone's become an environmentalist. So I get what you're saying, that this is a political issue. Now, on this case, the work with Gauss was more difficult than Kepler, because Kepler pretty much tells you his method. So how did you begin to get at this method of Gauss?
Our approach to it was that we had to get inside of his mind. And in order to do that, we first began by going to the context in which he was emerging, in which he was, you know, coming to his young adulthood, which was you had essentially a renaissance in Germany in the late 1800s. The late 1700s, around the circles of Abraham Kästner and Gotthold Lessing, and Moses Mendelssohn, that these circles had created, after the death of Leibniz, which Kästner and Lessing and Mendelssohn were all in the tradition of, they had created a defense against the push to bring empiricism, the teachings of John Locke, the teachings of Hobbes, the teachings of Isaac Newton, into the continent. And unlike most of the continent, the areas that this grouping focused in on, particularly Göttingen University, and the areas that Lessing was in, and Mendelssohn in Berlin, were able to preserve the epistemology and even advance the epistemology of Leibniz in these areas. Now, that was what Gauss came up in. That was what the Humboldt brothers came up in, and that's also what Schiller came up in. And so the first thing we did was go back and look at that, look at where he came from, how he must have thought, where his own ideas of philosophy must have come from, and started there, and then started to look at the problems and take on the problems, confront them as problems confronting ourselves, not just as not just outside of the problems looking at how he dealt with it, but trying to solve all the problems ourselves and see how we think through it, knowing the epistemological approach that he must have taken in order to think in the way that he did about the problems.
So you had to basically go through two processes then. On the one hand, looking at how he approached the problems, but also what was the hegemonic viewpoint at that time that was opposing what he was doing. Why would the British Empire, Merv, push empiricism?
Well, it keeps the population from developing not only technologies that are going to advance the population, that are going to bring populations, particularly nation states, out of the control of British free trade policies and things like that. But it creates something in the population where they have a sense of their own strength, their own capacity to discover principles, their own capacity to recognize the unboundedness of the prosperity of humanity if such discoveries are made. And so that's the key intent in the British empiricism, is to really stop the populations from thinking in that way. And that's what LaRouche has often referred to it as, this Promethean principle, to crush the Promethean principle. It's the oligarchical Zeus attempting to crush Prometheus, who is bringing fire to man.
So in our modern language, we would say it's a way of dumbing people down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Leona. Sorry.
LaRouche, actually, the most very recent paper, he pointed out that this exact attempt to impose empiricism on the population is also the doom of the British Empire, for the specific reason that a population can't survive without discoveries. And yet, if you have a population that's discovering and has a sense of humanity and the potential for humanity to develop, that population will not accept an empire system. So both ways, the British Empire is doomed.
Now, from what you said about Gauss, that his method was not made explicit, I take it you're basically saying that in times like the present, adopting a truly scientific outlook could be hazardous to your health.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hazardous in one sense. It keeps you a lot younger, and you'll probably live longer. Well, and you'll be a lot happier. But at the same time, you become probably the most serious threat to the empire, because you are, especially if you go out and organize. This is another main point. It's not that we're just, you know, developing a scientific capability in the basement here, but we're also part of organizing the population as a whole to start developing a scientific culture again, which was, you know, the boomers pretty much dumped that back in 1968. But one of our main jobs is to organize the population to become scientific again, which means that empire probably won't be around for much longer because of that. So it does make it dangerous to do scientific work in this way.
You're listening to The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, the 15th of March. We're talking to people who are in the basement. And if you've ever wondered the kind of work they're doing and its applications in the political fight, we'll take your emails. I think I'm going to have a hard time reading my screen here, but if you send in an email, we'll get them the question. And the emails can go to radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub, LaRouchePub.com. And also you can go to LaRouchePack.com to hear Lyndon LaRouche's historic webcast from last Wednesday, the 12th of March. Now, we're discussing this question of the investigation of science, and I think what we've established so far that science is not something that actually is done in ivory towers, but it's directly political and directly affects the society in which the scientist is working. How did you discover that with Gauss? What was the effect of what Gauss did with the paper on the orbit of Ceres?
Well, one thing, I can give you a little bit of a insight into Gauss. He, when he was in Göttingen University, he was, you know, completely flying high. He kept a notebook of all of his discoveries. It's called his Tagebuch, which, you know, every couple of days he jots down a new discovery that he made. He lays out all the different directions he's going, and he actually makes the breakthroughs at this time that lead into the major breakthroughs of the 1800s that Riemann makes, and then some of Gauss's other students like Dirichlet. But Gauss didn't go public with anything until 1799, when he published his doctoral dissertation on the fundamental theorem of algebra, which and his it's not really a companion piece, but his Disquisitionis Arithmeticae, which is his arithmetic textbook, which laid down the foundations for the dissertation itself. Which both of these things were received very, you know, poorly in at the Paris Academy, which was like the central scientific academy in Europe besides Göttingen University, where Gauss was. But these things were, you know, they were taken in, and Paris said, oh, you know, these are too difficult to look at, you know, the geometry, you know, he kind of cheated with the geometry, you know, it's really just arithmetic. But then, you know, they thought they could bury Gauss. But then you had this problem of the orbit of Ceres, where all the scientists of Europe were trying to determine the orbit of this thing because they thought that they would lose it if they didn't figure out the orbit. But they were all, they all had completely different answers, and none of them knew if they were right or not. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Carl Gauss publishes his ideas, which were completely rigorous. He did it four times, and Ceres was discovered exactly where Gauss forecast that it would be discovered. So right then, Gauss seriously became an international phenomenon all across Europe. And what was interesting is that he never revealed his method, but yet he was the only person that was able to determine the orbit of an asteroid, even through 1802, when they were discovering more asteroids. He was the one that kept determining the orbits of these new asteroids, and he wouldn't tell anybody how he was doing it. So he kind of went undercover right then because it became so popular so fast in the middle of a Napoleonic Empire. That's just one example. He for some reason got extremely freaked out about being public right after he discovered the orbit of Ceres. I'm not sure if he realized what kind of a phenomenon he would be, or what kind of a danger he would be in for being so creative and so public about it.
Now, you have also worked through the discoveries of Kepler, who's a little bit different from Gauss in that way, even though he lived in very turbulent times. But I presume it's the case that from Kepler, from his new astronomy and the Harmonica Mundi, you actually can follow the train of his thought and get at his method. Isn't that right?
Yeah, with Kepler, yeah, that was the point of his work, is to pose the beginning, which is the problem, then all of the mistakes and solutions and challenges to himself and future scientists. And that comprised his works. Gauss, on the other hand, is a different story, because he did publish his discoveries, but not at all in the sense that Kepler did. What he did was he posed what would essentially be the end of Kepler's book, which would be just the discoveries themselves. But then in the front, in the first half of the papers, they would be essentially a blackboard derivation. A derivation that would be acceptable to a logistical empiricist. But what's funny is that it still wasn't quite that, because a pure mathematician or a pure college student of today would still look at it and think it was a little weird, because at certain points he'll say, now I could have done the past 50 proofs with geometry very easily. But we'll skip that for now. It's just about one or two sentences that he says that. And then another thing is that in his book, the book that he finally comes out saying that it's his astronomy textbook, which has how he discovers the orbit of Ceres. Or no, it's how you calculate the orbit of Ceres in five different ways. But what's funny is that A an astronomer now, a so-called astronomer now, would look at it and still think it was a little weird, even though all the proofs are, they follow from each other. Because most people are familiar with words like velocity, acceleration, force, mass, and all these fundamentals, so-called, of mechanics and mechanics. But Gauss doesn't use any of those words. Actually, he only mentions mass a few times just to say he's going to ignore it.
Well, what would be wrong with this as a proposition? You said, say you take a university professor today, and he says, well, Gauss already showed us how to do it. Now we have equations or formulas. We have the mathematics that can give us this. So why do we have to know what was in Gauss's mind when he did it? Or why should we waste our time working through the new astronomy when we have instruments now that can give us readings, so we don't need that?
You're missing, because it misses the most essential point about what a true scientific discovery is. That I mean, a good example is you take there's this popular book called the Copernican Revolution or something like that by Thomas Kuhn, and you compare that to Kepler, and the biggest fallacy in people like Kuhn or other so-called history of science professors that you find at Harvard and other places like that is that they're looking just at whenever someone says something new, whenever they change they rearrange the chairs on they rearrange the furniture in the house, and they say that's the great revolution when people start talking about these things in a new way. Whereas they have a new opinion. Whereas with Kepler, there's something completely different in that. The way that he approaches the problem, the what you would say the epistemology of his approach, is completely revolutionary. What he shows mankind is capable of knowing is a quality of knowledge which had never before been shown to exist, or been shown that man could grasp such a thing. And it's the same case with Gauss as well. And you find that in Leibniz, and we're going to find that in Riemann. But that's the important thing about this core of Kepler and Fermat and Leibniz and Gauss is that their discoveries aren't just equations, aren't just new laws or something like that, but they're accompanied by a revolution in how you think about man's interaction with the universe, what man is capable of knowing. And the breakthroughs that really occur in their work is on the level of an epistemology of approach instead of just a new technology per se.
Well, and this is what LaRouche was talking about in the webcast when he raised this question of the goal of your scientific work. On the one hand, is the discovery of universal physical principles by which man is able to change the universe. But in fact, it's the ability to not merely make the discoveries, but then to transmit them that actually is a crucial part. Now, what I'm getting at is that you guys really are engaged in a kind of investigation of a mystery, which is that Gauss was not clear on his method. I assume you're going to publish what Gauss actually was thinking to the extent you were able to piece it together. Is that part of the ultimate goal of this project?
Yeah. I can give you a real quick example of that. The thing that we're about to put up on the website, the brunt of it deals with what Gauss called biquadratic residues. And if you look at his work on biquadratic residues, which he published in 1832, he published a first treatise in 1831 where it's just pure math. But then in 1832, he publishes this thing where he starts he goes through these biquadratic residues, which are residues of the fourth power, like x to the fourth power. But just a little ways into it, he says, all right, you know, we've just developed this huge maze of theorems and so forth, and it's completely confusing. We don't see any patterns unless we introduce the use of complex numbers to arithmetic. But in order to do that, we have to look at complex numbers in terms of geometry. And so then he begins to develop the whole idea of like two-dimensional numbers, where you don't just count up, but you also count to the left and the right, right? Imaginary numbers are what they're fraudulently called today. But everything that he says, we need to bring these complex numbers, which are strange. You can't count to a complex number. But he said we have to bring them into arithmetic and give them equal rights with regular counting numbers. We have to enlarge the domain of arithmetic by an infinite degree by bringing these in. We have to go into a new mode of determination. But then if you look close, if you really think about it, everything that Gauss was bringing up in this paper was not in itself something new. People had been using complex numbers for decades before this paper. There was a geometric representation of complex numbers before this. People have been running into the problem of the biquadratic residues since the time of Cardan. But what Gauss did is he brought it in from a higher standpoint. He said, we need to revolutionize what our concept of what our general concept of magnitude is. Although all the mechanics people had already been using. But he said we need to revolutionize our general notion of magnitude, and right now we're looking in. Anyhow, that's what's going to be in the next thing that we put out. But we're now looking at what were the implications of that. What he did after the 1832 publication of this, and obviously the full fruition of this comes with Riemann in his 1854 paper on anti-Euclidean geometry.
Now, I think it was Merv who mentioned before the role of Abraham Kästner as an intervening figure between Leibniz and Gauss. I understand we did some work on Kästner. What did you discover about this figure?
Well, he's a really fun character. I mean, for one, he defined German satire. Like he would write all these epigrams, these satirical epigrams that were very punchy, he really created not just that side of it, which was the cultural side. I mean, he had grown up in Leipzig, which was where Leibniz was, which was where Bach was, and he was there until 1756. So he was there the entire time that Bach was there, and. He himself had been key in creating a cultural renaissance that was an anti-empiricist cultural renaissance by recruiting people like Lessing. Lessing was his student while he was a teacher at Leipzig University. And he also had Lessing's cousin, which he worked with Milius, I forget it's like Christlob Milius. And they had been key very early in the 1750s, in making, they had a project to make German a scientific language.
Mm-hmm.
And they were translating all these different works from English, from Swedish, from Latin, and they were translating it into German. And this was completely revolutionary. No one before this even wrote German wasn't even spoke at the palace. They spoke French at the palace under Frederick the Great. You know, the king of Prussia spoke mm-hmm. French, right? He didn't speak German.
They had some pretty evil French influences there also in Voltaire.
Yeah, well, he had, and that was also key. That was part of, there was, Voltaire was there, Maupertuis was there. Maupertuis was the head of the Berlin Academy. And these were all people that Kästner was diametrically opposed to in his thinking. And so he recruited a movement that created the a cultural impulse that really preserved the core of Leibniz's thinking through the empiricist push that was that had destroyed all the science in Paris and other places. And everybody wonders, if you read any popular histories, everybody says, well, how did Gauss came out of nowhere. Germany was had no scientific development. You know, all the scientific development in the 18th century was in Paris, or it was Laplace, it was Lagrange, it was people like that. Where did Gauss come from? You know, how did the Germans all of a sudden in the 19th century become the most scientifically advanced nation in the world? And really, it was because that they had preserved the anti-empiricist tradition, and this was because of Kästner. I mean, Kästner defined the entire curriculum of Göttingen University, at least in the sciences, and he had tremendous influence on the arts as well. I mean, his friends from his friend Gessner, I think it was, had come from Leipzig. He was a teacher at the Thomasschule, or the rector of the Thomasschule, which was where Bach was a teacher. So it was all there in Göttingen, and it was all really centered around Kästner, who also played a big part in reviving Shakespeare.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that Lessing, part of that translation project was the Shakespeare project in German. And one of the great practitioners, one of the great Shakespearean actors on the stage in German and in Austria was Schikaneder, who was the librettist for Mozart's Magic Flute. So you have direct connections to, from this Renaissance with Kästner in all areas. Now, you described that one of the things they did was they had a major translation project. I understand that as part of your work, you've been translating material. What kind of translations have you done, and when will these be available, either on a website or in some kind of form that's accessible to people?
Yeah, a large part of what we had to do, our decoding process of Gauss's discoveries, was to dig into a lot of German and Latin works, mainly because the Latin, because like Merv mentioned, up until the mid 18th century, German wasn't even considered a scientific language yet. So a lot of most of the works were in Latin and French, but the letters that he writes and people write about him are largely in German. And so we had to work around. We had to dig in the bushes and get and start translating all of these, anything that we could find that could have illuminated the situation around Gauss and the thought processes around in the environment that Gauss is living in. And so right now I think we have about 64 papers, anything from 2 paragraphs to 50 pages. And they'll all be available now in a couple of days on the website. And at some point we plan to publish a source book.
And do you plan a series of seminars to present this material?
Yeah, we actually... we're planning on having... the next group that comes out here is obviously going to be working on the continuation of Gauss's work through his student Riemann. But in order to understand Riemann completely, you have to know what he saw in Gauss, which means you have to know Gauss in depth. So part of our idea so far is to bring a bunch of people out for a period of time for a series of seminars that we're going to do detailing all of Gauss's work that we've looked at. Everything that, because when you teach a class, things come out in the class that you wouldn't necessarily think people needed to understand when you're writing a pedagogical. So doing a class is a different type of form than writing a pedagogical itself. So we're going to bring people out and do a bunch of classes for them so that we can train, like, not only the next group to go into the Riemann, but also the next teachers that can go out and then teach the Gauss work. And we haven't set a time for that. but it's in the near future, not so distant future.
So this project really, it really is to develop the history of science from its origins.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the things about science is that you can't understand science without understanding what who the people were that made the discoveries. You can't separate a discovery from a person. One of the big frauds of today, you have all these math formulas and physics math formulas that are named after people that didn't even discover the formula. So it's today, science is completely disconnected from the individuals.
Now, that's actually a significant point, because Gauss, of course, is called the Prince of Mathematics, but is he even studied in the way that you're doing, or even at all in mathematics departments these days?
No, the most extensive biographies that exist of him, the Dunnington, G.W. Dunnington, I think is considered the most extensive biography that's done, and for just the work that we've done here in the last year, I mean, even after 6 months of work on Gauss, it became immediately clear to us that all this material, even these considered, 400-page extensive biographies, they avoid the real issues, and they barely even scratch the surface. They're superfluous. I could say that they never really get at what people need to be investigating, which is how Gauss thought, and that's just not occurring. It's very rare that you find some people, but you do find some people. You know, you find some people in the population who his children read, Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, or you find other people that have read James Fenimore Cooper. It's rare. But you find that in the population, and that's also the advantage of having a culture that it's sort of built into the population, that people, maybe their grandparents grew up in that culture, and so it's in there, it's in the population, it's ready to be provoked in them again. But for the most part, it's not explicit, and it's definitely not promoted at the schools.
Well, I think that's the basis of what LaRouche means by a dark age, when your sense of history is almost non-existent, and your idea of science is a computer or a textbook. So we've been through this before, though, because the original dark age was after the murder of Archimedes. There was another dark age in the 14th century, and actually what you're investigating is the rediscovery, beginning with Cusa, of the work of the Pythagoreans. Did you go back into the work on the Pythagoreans on astronomy and or astronavigation, astrophysics?
Yeah, actually that was necessary as far as trying to figure out how Gauss thought, because that actually was his unique capability, as well as LaRouche's, is that what he's using, the tools he's using, is all of humanity, the development of all of humanity. And so, for example, it's very obvious that, it's explicit that he harks back to Kepler, but then, as far as the orbit of Sirius goes, but Kepler is explicit about harking back to Cusa, as well as the Pythagoreans. Now, the work that he does on the disquisitions, on the arithmetic, is explicitly undeniably Pythagorean. He's basically reviving, he's reviving the Pythagoreans by building on top of what they do.
Mm-hmm.
He's making it alive for the culture, which is what we need to do today, is to make the development of all human civilization alive for the population today.
I recently had a discussion with Lyndon LaRouche where he said that the history of mankind as a whole has a tragic story. It's a tragedy in the sense that there have been these brief moments of the flowering of schools that grew up around one person that literally had to fight to reject popular opinion, to introduce new ideas, and very often it ended badly for the people involved or for their students. I guess what we're looking at now is a period of breakdown where all the accepted ideas are collapsing. And so as a result, we now have the potential for a new era, a renaissance, where all these great ideas are pulled together. How do you communicate that? I mean, I know that you talk about publishing. We're going to put out translations. We'll have a website. You'll be doing some seminars. But clearly, this has to go out beyond just a small number of cadre. What are we looking at when we're talking about a population that's frustrated, that's ignorant, that's on the computer, that if they can't find it on Wikipedia, they don't think it exists? How do you move people to actually understand these much more profound conceptions?
Yeah, well, that's what organizing is, and I mean, the main thing of what we do is we're circulating the method of these real scientists, because you do need science to get out of a dark age, and we're at the edge of the worst dark age that the planet's ever seen. But one thing that I'll point out is when Bernanke decided that he was going to do an emergency cut of the interest rates at the end of January, and then the Federal Reserve did another interest rate cut, and there were other developments also, but Lynn came down in the basement right when that happened, and he said, look, these guys are crazy. This is a hyperinflationary policy, and it is going to take off right now. And then he deployed us immediately on putting together some kind of a pedagogical device to communicate that. And so we immediately halted all the Gauss work and shifted gears and started looking at hyperinflation and how it occurred in Germany between 1919 and 1923, the interwar period. And I think that Lynn's idea was that from the work that we had done on Gauss, from the method that we developed in looking into Gauss, but also realizing that when you look at Gauss, you're not really looking at the discovery. You have to use your creative nose, so to speak, and sniff out what Gauss was thinking. Lynn saw that with that kind of capability and the collaboration that we developed, we'd be able to dig into the meat, the real substance of hyperinflation. So we got together and we got a bunch of books together, we got a bunch of materials, and we started looking into how hyperinflation worked in Germany. And what we realized immediately is that there's a whole lot of axioms flying around. Like, Germany, they printed a bunch of money, and therefore, the currency collapsed in value. They had too much money, so it collapsed in value. We knew that it couldn't be that simple. So we got together and we systematically went through the axioms and we dug out what must be the principles. And in doing so, we ended up demonstrating the principle that Lynn laid out years back called the triple curve, where when you cut your production, you cut your investment into production of particularly the basic economic infrastructure of your own nation and capital investment, while at the same time rapidly increasing your monetary emission and the debt that you're trying to pay back with this monetary emission, then you have that's the recipe for a hyperinflationary blowout.
So, Peter, that then is why you can make the comparison between what happened in Germany in 1923 and what Bernanke and Paulson and the imbeciles at the European Central Bank are doing today, then, through the use of the triple curve.
Yeah, exactly. You show this to the population. Sky put together an animation where he shows that the triple curve is not a bunch of separate curves on a piece of graph paper, but that you have a connection where the increasing financial aggregates is being built on top of the collapse of the physical economy. And if you show that to people, you show the three-dimensional version to people, and you describe this is what's happening with the economy, then something clicks, because people can suddenly sniff out that the universe is not empty, but that what they're seeing in the news and so forth, there is a physical cause for all of this. Economics is not some kind of statistical random game, but that there are physical principles that drive an economic process, and what we're seeing now is we're seeing hyperinflation.
Well, I would recommend to all of our listeners that you get a hold of the 80-minute documentary. It's a historical documentary titled Firewall, and it goes through this breakdown of the financial system, the unleashing of hyperinflation in Germany in 1923, and how this precipitated created the conditions where the British oligarchy was able to impose fascism on Germany. That Hitler was not something that grew out of the German people, but was imposed by bankers in Germany who were under the direction and at gunpoint, literally, of the British and certain leading families in the United States, like the Harriman family and Prescott Bush, the grandfather of our president. So this is available. It's being produced as a DVD. We want to have people purchase it or call in for it, make a contribution, and produce it and get it out. So you can get this by calling our office at 800-929-7566. That's the LaRouche PAC number. It's 800-929-7566. And this is a brilliant historical documentary done by the people in the basement. Now, I would like to just shift a little bit further in the same direction, because the destruction of these of a science based on discovery of universal physical principles has been paralleled by the development of digital systems, which are literally turning young people into zombies and potential terrorists. I know you were involved, some of you were involved in the work on the Is the Devil in Your Laptop? How is it that the computer, Leibniz is working on the principle of the computer, how did it get turned into this tool which can be used to zombify a population?
Oh, well, it was easy. Franklin Roosevelt died. And then you had a whole development that the British were running before the end of the war, which is called cybernetics. Because during World War II, there was a lot of work being done in computing, and specifically for determining trajectories of missiles and bullets and things like that, like where you want to aim your gun. So there was a lot of computing that was needed number crunching. And there was serious work going on analog computers by a guy named Vannevar Bush at MIT, who was developing computers that worked on mechanical principles, which essentially acted out the principles involved in the calculations. But on the other hand, on the other side, you had the whole cybernetics project being run by the British, which were pushing digital systems in the electronics laboratory, and I think Norbert Wiener became the head of this thing soon afterwards. But when Roosevelt died, all funding for the analog computers were shut down. All emphasis was put on digital systems, because a digital system is a little tiny black box that you can't see inside of. You can't see the principles that are running the digital system. So you put these things into a box and you call it a computer, and all of a sudden you've got this alien thing inside your house that you have no idea what's going on inside of it. But then it's telling you how to think every day. So now we've got a whole bunch of youth running around the United States and around the world who are inside of a culture where you can't go out and get any kind of productive job. You're not being taught how the universe works at all anywhere in the schools. And so your social life is being spent on a computer which is telling you how to think. You don't know where any of these ideas are coming from. And you have no idea how to tell if they're true or not because your school sucks. So I think that's pretty much how it was done.
Well, now, I know that Sky has an article in the Sky Shields, is in the basement with the three that we're talking with today, has an article on digital versus analog systems. And I know you were trying to see if you could put together an analog computer. Have you made some progress with that?
No, we're waiting. We still have... We're planning on doing some experiments, but we haven't done it yet.
All right. But you're convinced that it's something that can be done.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sure. We had some ideas of what to build, but we won't give anything away before we do it. No.
Oh, but I will say, in Sky's article, he goes through very clearly how, you know, you can go out in your garage and get out your machine tools and build a machine that will draw a transcendental curve, which all we've gone into physics. I'll tell you what, we went into a physics machine shop at the University of Washington to ask them if they could machine an actual logarithmic curve, and the guy basically explained to us that it was completely impossible. All you can do is plot points in a computer and then connect the dots with the machine. But unfortunately for him, or fortunately for him, Sky gives you very clear instructions on how to draw out, how to act out an exponential curve in his paper.
All right, well, that's available also in a LaRouche Pack pamphlet, Is the Devil in Your Laptop? Or Is the Devil in Your Laptop? So that's available also through calling us at LaRouche Pack at 800-929-7566. Now, I presume part of what we're doing is getting out onto the campuses, since we're deploying at some of the major centers of so-called learning in the country, from Harvard to Stanford to the University of Texas to Georgetown. What kind of, and one of the points Lyndon LaRouche always makes is you can tell whether your work is good or not by the squawks that you get in protest. I know we had one big squawk in the form of an attempt to hijack the Kepler work. What else are you hearing? Are we getting more responses from the people who are trying to maintain the human cattle stuck in digital space? Anything you guys know about?
No, not recently.
Well, we got to do more work then, because there was I haven't seen it, but there was an article by someone connected to Wired magazine, wasn't there?
One of the attacks that we made, because this whole digital suicide culture is being promoted at the highest levels right now, especially by this Wired magazine, which is, you know, a strangely very popular but gross magazine. This guy wrote an article saying that Halo 3, it's wonderful because you can defeat the last boss by committing suicide, and it gives you this wonderful sense of relief. And it was a very widely promoted article. So we attacked it in the pamphlet, and so he wrote another article basically saying, oh, I was attacked by those LaRouche guys. Ha, ha, ha.
Well, these guys should know today is the Ides of March, and their tyrannies cannot last forever. As Schiller said, there is a limit to the tyrant's power. So we have a little less than 7 minutes to go. I just want to open the floor to you. If any of you have anything you want to add to the work you're doing, to what it's told you about the nature, the potential of human beings, you know, anything you'd like to add at this point.
What I realized actually throughout is that what we're doing as far as bringing the epistemology to the population is absolutely necessary to be able to pose even LaRouche's policies as far as why, for example, the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act is not only crucial but is the only way out of this crisis as of now. Because if the population can't, if the population can't think scientifically, then the policy based on scientific thinking cannot be sustained, and that it's not just the policies that LaRouche puts out are not just policies in themselves, but they're based on his discoveries of principle of how the human mind works and how a civilization survives, how a species survives. And so to be able to shape all the ins and outs of policy, the people who are making policy as well as the people who are carrying it out, namely the population, have to understand the principle behind those policies and basically be policymakers themselves, be scientific policymakers themselves. And so it really is that we have to create a scientific population.
Well, that is the basis of a real republic then, isn't it?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Another thing I'd add is that something that's really missing from the society, and something that developed amongst ourselves, but we didn't really. It took us a while to realize that we had developed it. was a certain sense of collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
That like that the society is working together for the progress of all humanity. And that was something that really, it's not there today, but it was something that our sense of cooperation as a group through the year that we've been working together, it really blows me away, and I think it blows a bunch of us away. And we didn't realize it until we started working on this video, and our ability to, you know, put together an hour and a half long documentary in 3 weeks that's of very high level quality is pretty amazing. But to not just as a work product, but for it to be epistemologically sound be really worked out as a thorough composition, that's something that very few people can do today, to be able to work together as a group to compose something that's artistic.
That's a one.
Yeah, that works as a one. And we realized that in that process, in the process of working on the video, that we had developed a sense of what it really means to cooperate, to work together. And now the idea is that we need to get that sense out into the rest of our organization, and as we bring, and that's part of what the Remon project is going to be promoting, as well as bring our context, as we're organizing, and people are seeing us organize, and people are seeing how we interact. It's also going to have a powerful effect within the society, and I think that's an additional aspect that was very important in the work and may not have been obvious from when we started the project.
Well, what in particular is obvious about it is that our society has devolved to the level of a Hobbesian society where people think that the expression of man is to engage in a struggle against all other men. And of course, that's why we have such a broken down society. So this question of collaboration is also really working for the benefit of the other, and that's the only way scientific discovery ever occurs. So we have less than a minute. Peter or Leona or Merv, you have anything final words?
Yeah, I'd just say this is a closing thing. You know, a lot of people today, they don't really get inspired about ideas. They get inspired about fads, you know, like the new popular band or, you know, whatever gets thrown at them on MySpace this week. But fads wear off pretty fast. But the ideas that we're communicating and that we're developing, communicating to the population, they have the quality of immortality, and so they last. That's a real sense of power. But that's also how you change society, is you instill ideas of principle into the population, and you make them infectious, and they travel through the population, and they will live on and form the population like no fad could ever even consider.
Well, I think that's a beautiful place to end our discussion today, because ultimately this question of fighting fascism is the question of providing true historic mission to every human being. And there's no more beautiful expression of that than in the discovery of universal physical principles in science and the development of the communication skills through classical composition to share those discoveries with others. So we'd like to thank you for listening to us on the LaRouche Show today. Peter, Leona, and Merv, thank you for joining us, and we'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time.
Thanks, Charlie.
All right.